Today is Saturday, December 4th, 2021. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jake Daley, D-A-Y-L-E-Y. My name is Tom Martin. This interview is conducted at our house in Flagstaff, Arizona. Jake, thank you so very much for your willingness to visit with us here today. What year were you born?
I was born in 1981.
Where?
In Bismarck, North Dakota.
What were your folks doing in Bismarck?
Well, my dad was an adjunct psychology professor, and he took jobs all over the West.
Wow.
And just prior to that, they were living in Missoula, and he got a job in Dickinson, which is west of Bismarck. So we had just moved there late in my mother's pregnancy, and then for the birth, we moved, or we visited Bismarck because it was a bigger city with a hospital.
Hmm. Did you grow up in North Dakota then, or did your father keep moving?
My parents divorced when I was four.
Okay.
My father stayed, he had a lot of wanderlust, so he continued to move about. My mother and I moved to Phoenix, Arizona, where my grandparents lived.
Okay.
Actually, they had both just died.
Okay.
So they didn't live there currently, but had been living there.
Okay.
And so we occupied their house.
Hmm. Okay. And is that where you grew up then, was Phoenix?
Yes.
So introduced to the desert
right
at an early age?
Every summer my dad had custody, so for 9 to 10 weeks I would go up mostly to northern Utah. And my dad is very outdoorsy.
Ah.
So we would spend much of that summer, he had the summer off because he was a professor. We'd spend much of every summer hiking and backpacking, and mostly in northern Utah, but throughout Idaho, Montana, Colorado, a bit in Nevada.
What did your father do to help you as a child start enjoying that?
I think it was strictly just exposure to it.
Cool.
He instilled in me a lot of values. And we just did it so much, I enjoyed it from the get-go. I always wanted to go. I had brothers who did not want to go.
Okay.
And they were towed along during some trips. And other times it would just be Dad and I. And I just always loved to be outside.
Were your brothers older or younger?
They're stepbrothers, and they're both younger. They're 2 and 4 years younger. So my dad remarried when I was 7.
Okay.
So these stepbrothers at the time were 5 and 3, and they're not outdoorsy folks.
Okay.
And so they got dragged along a lot.
Okay.
Until they were old enough to stay home, and then they preferred to do that.
Did you then, when did you start heading out on your own? Maybe in Phoenix or even up with your dad in the summers, start doing your own exploring.
Early. My dad let me go out by myself from an early age, I'd say early teens, for day hikes.
Okay.
Not sure how old I was my first solo backpack trip, but maybe later teens.
Did you develop friends in Phoenix that were outdoorsy, that did outdoors kind of stuff?
Not until the end of high school. I fell in with a guy who I've since lost contact with. His name was Paul Klink. And in the last couple of years of high school, K-L-I-N-K. In the last couple of years of high school, we did a handful of backpacking trips around Phoenix and the Bradshaws and the Superstitions, areas like that.
Okay. When was your first visit to Grand Canyon? Do you remember that?
My first time into the canyon is 1996. During high school, my mother and I actually did several consecutive years of Havasupai trips. Prior to that, I had been on the South Rim and North Rim, but I had not ventured down. I had wanted to, but just was not able to at the time. And
were
so,
those with your mom or your dad?
Mom.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So she was kind of outdoorsy as well.
A bit. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. She enjoys the outdoors. She doesn't get after it to the same extent that my dad does, but she enjoys camping and sightseeing, and in the past 20 years we've done a lot. Just trips to the South Rim, North Rim.
Okay.
Looking down at the canyon so I can point things out and
cool
things like that. Yeah.
Cool. When was your first solo backpack that you remember?
That I remember clearly would be shortly after I moved to Flagstaff in summer 2000. I just hiked out around Walnut Canyon. I think I spent the night at Fisher Point and then walked out further east, kind of the area that's now the Arizona Trail, and spent a few nights out.
Cool.
I guess I went once prior up in Utah, up above the city of Ogden, up in the mountains, just for one night there.
Okay.
And I might have been 16 or something then.
And the reason I ask is because it shows a level of confidence in your skills. You've got camping down, you got the backpacking down. It's typically, in quotes, a journey taken with others. But when you start going by yourself, then now it's a new door that you open there.
And that's primarily, these days, the trips that I do are solo trips.
Mm. Okay. When was your first hike in Grand Canyon?
It would be those Havasupai trips.
Okay.
In the eastern part of Grand Canyon, not until 2000 when I moved here.
Okay. Then let's back up a bit. So Havasu was in 96. Did you guys hike in? Did you use the mules for packing your gear in and out? Or?
The first year, I believe, well, we hiked in all 3 years. I think the first year we used the mules, and the next 2 years we did not. And they were family trips, so it was my mom and I, and then I could bring a friend, which I did every year, and I would typically have a cousin or an aunt or an uncle go.
Cool.
And the young folks would take a day and venture down to Beaver Falls or the river. And, you know, I think we'd be there 3 days and then hike back out.
Nice. So it was crowded, but it wasn't crazy crowded like it would become in the next 15 years or so.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I actually have not been to Supai itself since then.
Hmm.
I've off a river trip gone up to Beaver, but I've never seen the main waterfall since, I think, 1998.
Okay.
And so I hear it's much more crowded.
Yeah. Was it assumed with certainly father as an adjunct professor, was it assumed in your family that you would go to college?
Yes.
And what were your interests in high school that started to direct you into college?
I don't know that I had a specific career path. I didn't have any of that established in my head. I think I went to college more because it was the thing to do, and my parents had gone, so I was second generation. My grandparents did not. It was just the expected path to take after high school. And so I wasn't gung-ho on college. I had saved up a lot of money, and after high school I took a 2.5 month road trip where my friend and I slept in the back of the truck and toured the U.S. and Canada. And at the end of that I was not at all sure I was even going to college.
Uh-huh.
But I found myself at NAU and it was a good fit, and I quickly fell in with the Parks and Recreation management folks who were, I found, very like-minded, kindred spirits all around.
Nice.
Both professors and students, and that I really sank my teeth into that.
What years did you actually get a Parks and Rec degree then?
Yes.
What's it actually called? Outdoor management? There's a word.
It was just called Parks and Recreation Management. My emphasis was outdoor leadership.
Okay.
But there are other emphasi that one could take.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But mine was outdoor leadership.
Okay. When did you graduate?
In 03.
When did you start climbing?
I usually pinpoint 1999 as the year that I started climbing. I had tinkered around prior to that, mostly bouldering. But I really began rope climbing and using advanced techniques in 1999. I learned many of them from, I think my mother got tired of me taking horrendous risks, and so she hired a guide. I don't recall his name, but he was through the Arizona Mountaineering Club.
Okay.
And that guy took me out for a couple days into the McDowell Mountains north of Phoenix. And from there I learned how to belay and, how to the general rope work involved in climbing and
Did
climbing gear
you
and
buy your own, start buying your own gear?
yes, yeah.
Okay.
Prior to that, I had climbing shoes and a chalk bag and that's it.
We were bouldering, but
Yeah.
wasn't doing anything kind of major than that.
Yeah.
Can you tell me one or two of your first sort of major climbs?
Well, the Praying Monk on Camelback Mountain was early on. And then, boy, a lot of my early ones were top roping in the Queen Creek area or Camelback Mountain, some of the very easy little multi-pitch climbs on the head. There's Peidrick's Chimney, which is a 1950s era 5-1, and I don't recall the names of the other really easy routes there, but there's quite a few routes in the 5-0 to 5-6 range that ascend the head of Camelback Mountain. And so I tinkered around there, and I tinkered around at a spot in Phoenix called Papago Park, which is a place no one should ever climb.
Why not?
Oh, the rock is about as bad as Grey Castle.
Oh, so you had some good experience then.
Yeah,
So yeah,
yeah,
some learning.
yeah.
And so living at Flagstaff, this is a bachelor's degree that you were working on,
That's right.
would have given you close proximity to Grand Canyon. Did that then increase your hiking and climbing in the Grand Canyon?
Initially, no. Well, it increased my hiking. I, in the first many years that I lived in Flagstaff, I frequented Grand Canyon maybe once a year, maybe twice.
Okay.
So the hook was not set until quite some time later.
All right.
So I had done, yeah, like I say, 1 to 2 backpacking trips per year from maybe 2000 until 2011.
Okay.
I enjoyed it, but I was not obsessed by any means. And I did not climb in the Grand Canyon at all during those years.
Okay. Did you climb anywhere else near Flag?
Yeah. I climbed very extensively around Flag, starting sport climbing and traditional climbing with the Pit and the Overlook and Paradise Forks. And then in really 2001, I got heavily into Sedona climbing. And that was my primary focus. And still is. At this point, it's secondary to the Grand Canyon, but I climb most frequently in Sedona and have for 20 years now, and have established a lot of new climbs down there, and that's where I love to climb the most up here.
So tell me about the rock similarities between Sedona and Grand Canyon.
Well, clearly there's the Coconino Sandstone, which occupies both places. In Sedona, many of the climbs are in the coke, as we call it. Some of them are in some lower supai-like layers. They call it the Schnebley Hill Formation down there in the canyon. It's the supai. But I think they're one and the same, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Yes.
So spending a lot of time climbing in Sedona
Right.
is equivalent to spending a lot of time climbing in the same rock in Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Cool. And the Coconino is a sandstone, as they say, is sort of here. There's a really good handhold right there. Here, let me give it to you. Because I don't need it, because it doesn't anchor to anything.
Oftentimes that is very accurate. Yeah, it can be quite soft. And then in places it can be bullet hard. Mm. And my partner on Grey Castle is a fellow named Zach Harrison. Harrison. And Zach. And at this point, I think he... Between the two of us, he has more extensively climbed in Sedona. He came to that game later than I did, but he's extremely prolific. I would guess he's put up over 100 new routes in Sedona now.
Wow. Okay.
So he's quite experienced in that sandstone, that soft sandstone as well.
So thank you for this introduction. I should mention that the topic of today's interview is the first ascent of Grey's Castle, a named butte in Grand Canyon National Park. Can you tell me a little bit more about Zach, how you met him, and how it came to be that both of you thought, hey, let's try to climb Grey's?
I'll try to put it as short as possible. That's quite a long answer. I think I met Zach maybe 2011. I had moved back to town. I was living in Lake Tahoe briefly and moved back to Flagstaff. And in the interim where I was absent, he had moved to town and kind of established himself as a Sedona climber. And then I came back and, you know, we met because we both love to climb in Sedona. And largely we have not climbed together. We've had different partners and we're pursuing different things in Sedona. He more the big routes back in the Coconino on the Good Rock, and me chossy little unclimbed spires. And so our paths didn't cross too frequently. We did climb together on occasion, but not too frequently. And I knew of Grey Castle. I'm not sure when I first came to know of it. I probably heard of it from Matthew Brown in about 2015 and became really interested because I learned it was the only unclimbed named summit within the Grand Canyon. And so in short order, I organized a trip out there with my friend Everett, which was unsuccessful.
Can you explain to me exactly where Grey Castle is?
Yeah,
Grey. And what it is?
Grey Castle is a small tower on River Left at River Mile 55.4, which is about 1 mile upstream of Quaggunt Rapid.
Quaggunt.
Right.
Yeah.
And it is a tower composed almost entirely of Bright Angel shale. The capstone is the Muav limestone, which is why the tower exists.
So the capstone, the Muav capstone, is harder to erode, is tougher,
right,
than the shale below it. When I think of shale, I think of slate roofs but that slate, it's been cooked a little bit, metamorphosed. Shale can be like sort of dirt.
Yeah, shale is hard to even define as rock. It hasn't been metamorphosed, and as you might imagine, it's quite soft.
Okay.
In places you can literally dig your finger into it.
Okay.
So it doesn't inspire confidence in the rock climber.
So where exactly, how would one get to this place? It's along the banks of the Colorado River, so riverers can easily get there.
Right.
So how are you going to get there as a climber with your climbing gear?
Well, the first time I went in, we began on the Nankoweap Trail, number 57, the one that begins in the House Rock Valley, and descended it to the river with ridiculously heavy packs.
When was this?
This was 2016.
Okay.
Winter 2016. That was with Everett Carroll, Carol, and Everett. The third.
Okay.
And I think his pack, he's a big, strong guy. His pack was something like 68 pounds. And I'm a little guy. My pack was 55 or something, which is still way too heavy.
No kidding.
But we had way too much gear. We didn't know what we were getting into, so we brought everything from double 60-meter ropes to a triple set of cams to a number of pins of different sizes, a hammer, some bolts, a hand drill, quick links. We had...
So before you get into the gear here, I'm thinking, wait a minute, you got these heavy packs. You're hiking down the Nankoweap Trail, but the Nankoweap Trail is on one side of the river and Gray Castle is on the other side of the river.
Ah.
How did you get across and get back again?
Pack rafts. So pack rafts, there are many different types and they've evolved quite a lot in the past 20 years especially. You have folks like Harvey Butchert, who had an inflatable air mattress that he used to navigate the river quite successfully. And nowadays there are pack rafts, which are small inflatable rafts made out of material that varies from slightly tougher than a pool toy to actual rafting material. And so in our case, because we were simply crossing the river and floating a very flat section, we used Supai pack rafts. The smallest of those is only a pound and a half. And the paddle that goes with them is also similarly light, maybe 1 pound or something like that. So it's very minimal. They pack down to smaller than the size of a sleeping bag and its stuffed sack. And you blow them up with your own lung power, generally, in the case of the Supais, and put yourself and your pack inside them and cross the river. In the case of Nankoweap, there is one small riffle. It's unnamed, and it's maybe a quarter mile below Nankoweap Rapid. And if you get in the tail waves of that, you can float all the way to Gray Castle with no issues at all. And so that's what we did both times that I went out there.
So you would go from the rim down to Nankoweap and then walk down along the river, blow up your pack, hop in the water right there, and then exit at the base of the castle.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And then, so your retreat is going to be back across the river and then hike back out again because your vehicles are up there at the head of the Nankoweap Trail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So now we've got in and out. So what happened on that first ascent attempt with Everett?
I got up about 20 feet and Everett kind of said, I'm not doing this. A lot of rock had already fallen onto Everett. And I couldn't help it. The nature of the shale, it just comes off in your hand.
And how do you set protection? Sorry to interrupt here, but I'm like, wait a minute. How do you? So you've got cams, which are little devices that can expand into cracks. And assuming you had a bolt kit,
mm-hmm.
or you might have assumed, no, we'll leave that at home because it won't work. But I don't know.
No, we had a bolt kit.
And pitons, various sizes of chocks, which are basically like glorified walnuts that you can hook into little cracks.
That's right.
Was there any other slings to hang off these things?
Mm-hmm.
Any other climbing gear specifically that you could describe for us that you had in your toolbox?
No, that pretty well covers it. The second time I went, I had these special pitons made for me by a friend in Phoenix, Art Christensen. And they are 9-inch long hardened aluminum pitons that Art thought might better fit the crack, the nature of the cracks there, and be more secure in the crack. And so we had those, but we never used them.
Let's go back to 2016, you and Everett there. So this tower is sitting on a little hillside. The west side of it drops right down next to the river.
Mm-hmm.
And the east side is kind of on this ridge. So I'm assuming you guys went around to the east side, because that ridge coming in is only leaves, what, 140, 150 feet?
That's right.
To
yeah.
climb.
Mm-hmm.
So how did it come to pass that Everett's like sitting right under you? Because there would have been a lot of stuff coming down, I can imagine. It's a gurk pile.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. So the river side is unclimbable because there is no continuous crack system that reaches the summit.
Okay.
The other side, the short side, the saddle side, is climbable because it has a few crack systems to choose from. They're generally discontinuous, but you can link them together via ledges and kind of link your way up crack systems all the way to the top, or so it seemed to us. And so we chose that side. I started up what I thought to be the best line, and at about 20 feet up, having put in, generally climbers will put in a piece of protection, assuming the rock is good, roughly every 8 to 10 feet. And in this case, the rock quality is so poor that the quality of the gear is then poor. It may rip out because the rock would just blow out around it. And so you're putting in sometimes double pieces that are equalized together with a sling, meaning that should the climber fall, an equal amount of force would be placed on both of the pieces, so that the pieces themselves would be less likely to blow out the rock than a single piece alone. And many pieces are placed, and by many I mean every 2-3 feet, just to prevent anything catastrophic from happening. If one or two fail and blow out the rock, you're still going to be off the ground in the event of a fall, and nothing catastrophic would happen. So part of our reasoning in bringing so much gear is we're just going to sew this thing up with gear to minimize any actual danger.
Tell me about the cracks. What sort of cracks are we talking about? Are they fairly wide? Are they fairly tiny? Are they deep? What? Because I'm thinking about the Brain Angel Shale is sort of like trying to climb the side of a ream of paper if I'm an ant. I mean, it's just all these little horizontal layers.
Yeah.
Very crumbly.
The cracks in Bright Angel Shale are rotten. That is probably the best adjective I can think of to describe them. And they exfoliate. And so the surface, 1 to 2 inches, generally rips out. And so the cracks that we were following are both wide and narrow. They vary a lot. But in general, any type of gear that you're placing has to be placed deep. The trigger of a cam, for example, has to be just buried in there, because the external 1 to 2 inches is rotten, which makes the cracks for the most part impossible to free climb, because you have nothing substantial to grab. It will just all break.
Hmm.
And so much of the climbing on Grey Castle ended up being aid climbing, meaning we placed gear, attached aiders to it, which are similar to rope ladders, stood up in the aiders, placed another piece, attached more aiders or rope ladders to those, and kind of mechanically ascended the cracks so as not to have to pull on this rotten rock.
Did you do that in 2016?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so you guys were doing that right from the start in 2016. In 2016, did you see any signs of anyone else having attempted to climb the castle?
No signs, but I know of prior attempts.
Okay.
But I think the signs would have vanished because the rock is so soft.
Hmm.
In other types of rock, you can see things like pin scars, which are scars from pitons and other things being banged into cracks, and those are long since gone if they were ever there. But I do know of at least two prior attempts on Grey Castle in the past 20 or 30 years.
Okay.
Maybe more than two.
Yeah. Yeah, it has been looked at by a number of people over the years, and all unsuccessfully, or at least you guys are the first documented success. So 2016 taught you what?
That I need a very experienced partner, both in soft rock and in aid climbing techniques. Someone equal, if not more competent than myself.
Okay. And typically aid climbing is where you have an anchor, but maybe you're climbing a ceiling and there's nothing under you. And so you put your feet in loops. You're basically like a rope ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of go from protection to protection to protection.
Yeah.
And when I think of other aid climbing where bolting is allowed, and you sort of take a drill and set a rock anchor, and then put your aid device, your little fabric anchor, your ladder, on the anchor, on the bolt, and then you go for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So without bolting, you're relying on chocks or cams in cracks every foot?
Oh, not that often. The crack that Zach and I chose to take on the more recent attempt was a little bit better. I would say protection was placed more like every 3 feet on average.
So a big step between pro to pro.
Yeah.
Okay.
If rock were excellent, and you could do what's called top stepping in your aiders, which is climbing to the highest step of the rope ladder, so to speak, then pro could be 5 feet apart. But in this case, I would say on average it was 3. And there are spots where the cracks end and there are mandatory free climbing moves, in which case we would place... We did have bolts and we hand drilled them, although there are very few, and in most about half the cases, we drill what's called drilled angles. And so we would drill a hole because there was nothing else there and pound a piton into the hole, basically. Although 90%+ of the climb is clean aid, meaning not bolts or pins, things that come back out of the rock.
So you actually left some pitons in the rock.
Right. Because
you couldn't beat them out.
Right.
Yeah.
In the case of the anchors on the top of both pitches, it was not really possible to build a safe anchor with gear.
Hmm.
And so in those cases, there's permanent protection there.
Okay. So 20 feet in 2016... and then a retreat with huge packs.
Yes.
What did that climb do for you? Did that inspire you to try it again? Or did that just say, well, we're done with this?
Oh, no. It lit the fire under me. I instantly wanted to come back. I felt like we could have gone farther. Felt like it could be climbed. And felt not only like I could climb it, but that other people could too, which made me want to get back even quicker. And so I had 5 other permits to go back, all of which failed for one reason or another. It's almost unbelievable at this point. I had one the next year with an extremely talented climber named Jake Tipton, the most talented climber I've climbed with in 20 some years of climbing at this point.
T-I-P-P-T-O-N?
T-I-P-T-O-N.
Thank you.
And we got all the way down to the river, and typical of Grand Canyon, the storm that was supposed to come in the next day, came in that day, and you absolutely cannot climb on Bright Angel Shale when it's wet.
Mm.
So we didn't even cross the river. So we hiked down, didn't even cross the river, and came back out. Then I had a trip the next year with Matthew Brown and this same fellow, Zach Harrison. And, oh,
2018?
Probably 2018, yeah. And I think that was also rained out. And then I had another one with the two of them. And in this case, Matthew had been on a prior trip earlier in the year. So this was, he was on a private river trip in February of 2019. And we filled two haul bags up with gear. And he eddied out at Grey Castle and hiked those haul bags up behind this large boulder and left them there. Because we had a permit only 6 weeks later. And I do not recall how that one failed, but it could have been weather. There was one that failed because Matthew bailed, and then Zach and my vehicles were not reliable enough to make the trip out there at the time. Matthew was our ride.
Okay.
Then there was a final trip last year in the spring of 2020, so now the haul bags have been out there for over a year. And that failed because... spring of this year. And that failed because Matthew and Zach both got their COVID vaccines just prior to the trip and were suffering the side effects from the vaccine and couldn't fathom that long of a hike, especially with a heavy pack. So I got another permit for that ended up being the successful one, which was this October. And all in all, it was either the sixth or seventh permit I've had to climb Grey Castle, all of which have failed in the past.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
King Bruce, you know that story?
No.
He's just totally getting trounced in battle, and he's watching this spider trying to climb his tent pole. You know, it's falling, and it climbs up, and it falls, and it climbs up, and it falls, and it climbs up, and it falls. And eventually that spider gets to the top, and he comes out and rallies his troops, and off they go, and they win the battle. And so...
Just King Bruce.
I'm going to start calling you King Bruce now.
I had certain friends and significant others who said, Jake, maybe this is a sign. you shouldn't mess around with this one.
So when did you start? Do you remember the date you guys had for the trailhead?
Yeah. Let's see. We climbed it on October 24th. So I think our permit was October 23rd through October 26th. We had four days.
So four climbing days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One day to get there. Now, you were relying on the gear that Matthew had placed back in 2019. Is that right?
Yes, although I'm lucky enough to have friends in the river guiding community, and those friends had intermittently checked on the bags to ensure their integrity.
Okay.
Every season, basically.
Great.
So I had a friend who works for ASRA check within a month before our trip. I think he was out there.
Great.
And he said everything's fine.
Super. So the gear was there.
Yeah.
So your packs wouldn't have been so super crazy heavy.
Right.
But you still need a life jacket, paddle, pack raft, food.
We brought some extra cams and...
Okay.
I think our packs were much more reasonable. I think they were both under 40 pounds for the trip down.
Great. But then you got to remove that stuff. So we can figure a river trip and come in and get that stuff and...
Yeah, which has already happened.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. So, did you actually get to Gray's on the 23rd?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it was something like 11 hours, 10 or 11 hours from the car all the way to Grey Castle. And we camped in a nice sandy spot right off the river.
Nice. So you got water there and you mm-hmm. got some shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then what happened on the 24th?
Bright and early, we hiked up there. Like you say, it's right above the river, and so it's literally a 15-minute approach. Only 15 minutes because the terrain is very steep. And we stood around for about a half hour deciding on which route to take, whether to take the one I had tried 5 years prior or whether to take the only other logical line, which I had considered 5 years prior and opted to not take. And Zach, Harrison, and I this time decided to take the other line, which is more direct, but looks from the ground to be more difficult. And Zach volunteered to take the first pitch, and so he racked up and started up that 95% aid climbing. Like I say, there is the occasional spot that requires a free move, so that involves clearing off as much loose rock as you can, so you have a handhold that is actually going to stay in place, and then doing one or two moves to reach another crack system and place gear in it. And so he took the first pitch and did marvelous on it. And there was a ton of rock fall. I was constantly moving the belay strategically to be out of the rock fall zone, and was lucky enough to not get hit with anything big. Got hit with dozens of small rocks, but wasn't fazed by that. And then Zach got up to the first belay ledge, which, as I say, would not accept adequate natural protection. So some bolts were hand drilled there, which is a very tedious process. The rock, although it's brittle, the sections of it that are adequate for bolts are extremely dense. And so both Zach and I have placed many bolts in Sedona, and the amount of time it takes to place a bolt in that Bright Angel Shale of Grey Castle is 3 to 4 times what it takes to place a bolt in the Sedona Sandstone. So although it breaks, it's the sections that are good, it's kind of like a matrix that holds together lots of chunks. And if you can find a significant portion of that matrix, it's actually very hard and very dense. And so it takes a very long time to pound in a bolt, which is another reason we tried to not place any, because it was just an absolute waste of time.
A time killer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how high up was Zach at the top of the first pitch where he was able to set a decent anchor and then have you climb up to him?
I think the first pitch is about 70 feet.
Okay. And
it ends on a sloping ledge, which is why we chose that to end the first pitch. After that,
sloping away from the castle or sloping to the castle, so it's a nice little thing to kind of like a park bench to keep
away,
you in place
away from the castle,
so it's like off into air.
Yeah.
As you came up, did you clean up the line? Did mm-hmm. you pull all the hardware?
Yes.
Okay, so mm-hmm. you're assuming you guys are going to set anchor and wrap off the top and that's it. You're not going to need any of this junk to get back down again.
If it had come to it, we could have wrapped off the belay bolts that Zach had placed.
Okay. And what time was it that you got up to him?
What time of day?
Yeah. Having started, I'm assuming, near first light.
Yeah, I would say we were probably climbing by 8 a.m., so it might have been 10 a.m. when I got up to him.
Okay, so he's making pretty good time.
Yeah, he's fast. And then I had been dreading the second pitch because from the ground it looks like the most horrendous pitch of all. It has this off width crack, meaning a crack that's 4 to 6 inches wide, and it goes into a chimney, meaning a wider crack, wide enough for a human body to fit in, and it overhangs, and it's just full of junk. And so I was not looking forward to leading the second pitch. In fact, the whole time Zach was leading the first pitch, I had this sickening feeling in my stomach about what I might encounter on the second pitch.
I wonder if that's exactly what Everett was thinking.
Probably
in,
so.
Back in 2015. Yeah, when you're in it and you're on it, it's one thing. When you're looking at it, it's something else.
Yeah.
The climb that Zach did for the first pitch, was that basically a vertical climb, or did he end up tracking off to one side or another following this crack system?
More or less vertical. It deviates to the left at about the halfway point of the pitch, but not too much. So okay. I'd say from bottom to top, he's maybe 5 feet to the left of where I'm standing at the base of the route, 70 feet higher, and maybe 5 feet to the left.
Okay, so still dropping rocks on you, but the big stuff can land to the side of you. And
yeah.
Now you're going to have to, whoever's going to belay is going to be on this ledge
mm-hmm.
with the climber right above them dropping junk down on them that way until they get out of the way enough.
Yes, he had the worst belay duty, for sure.
Okay,
he couldn't move. He got nailed with nothing, again, nothing terribly big, but some good sized chunks. He got nailed pretty good.
Okay. So even though you're not really thrilled about this second pitch, you still willing to go ahead and lead it?
Yeah, Zach improved my confidence a lot. He got to the belay, and I said, you know, how does that second pitch look? I'm yelling up at him from the ground, and he said something like, it doesn't look as bad as it did from the ground. It looks like there's a section of good rock and you can get some good pieces up there. And that made me feel significantly better. And then when I reached the belay ledge with Zach, I looked up and thought, oh, he was right. It looks worse than it is from the ground.
Okay.
And although there is a lot of junk in it, there's also some clean-looking cracks where I could get some reliable protection. And part of my fear was I'm not going to find any good protection, and I'm going to be in a really dangerous situation. And so ultimately, we're continuing upward as long as we can mitigate objective danger to a certain extent. If things are looking too dangerous, you know, it's just time to bail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least that's how my mind was working.
And neither one of you had fallen, taken a fall by this point, I'm assuming.
No, yeah, no falls.
Okay.
Right.
And Zach says, great, I'll anchor in, you're on belay, climb on.
Yeah, yeah, that's the gist of it. So I started up, and there's a blank section of rock for about 15 feet. I very tediously put a bolt in that. Did not want to place another one after that, so it meant mandatory free climbing up into this hole. If you see Grey Castle from the river, it has this feature on the upstream side that is kind of like a turret on an actual castle. And that turret is separated from the main castle near the top by a hole and a subsequent chimney. And so I got up above this bolt, and knowing that any fall I might take would be caught by the bolt, I committed to some free climbing because I just did not want to place another bolt, and there were no cams available. So I committed to the free climbing, ripped some stuff out, which hit Zach, but kind of clawed my way into this hole. And in the hole, you're safe. It's like a ledge inside the castle. You can see through to the other side. And in the top of the hole is a nice clean crack.
Back up a second. See through to the other side, not all the way through the castle, but in this kind of tower.
All the way through the castle.
All the way through the castle?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, where the turret is attached to the castle.
Right. So, I'm thinking. So if the castle is a cup, and the turret is a pen next to the cup,
mm-hmm.
you can see daylight
between
the pen and the cup. That's right. See daylight all the way through the cup.
Right.
Right.
I get what you're saying. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So how are you going to set protection in there?
So first, I spent a lot of time just moving rocks out the other side. So they fell probably 250 feet down to the ground because there was literally nothing secure to even stand on.
Mm.
Then standing on relatively secure things, you could get up into the top of this kind of window slash hole. And there was a crack up there that took excellent protection.
Mm.
I'd say probably the best protection on all of Grey Castle.
And how much higher are you now than Zach?
Oh, not too much. Only maybe 15 to 20 feet.
Okay.
So I placed, I think, 3 cams in this little section of excellent rock.
Mm.
And then it was time to kind of commit to more free climbing.
Up between the pencil and the cup in this chimney.
Yeah, and it's overhanging. It's climbing out a roof of sorts because you're climbing out of this hole back onto the face and around. And so I did kind of a combination of aid climbing and free climbing. And poor Zach, just there was nothing I could do. There's so much rubble in there. In order to have any upward progress at all, rubble just fell. And he got nailed. And then I scratched my way up onto the kind of the ledge between the turret and the castle. And there was a lot of debris in there, which I cleared out on the opposite side of the castle. Kind of got my bearings and looked up at the remaining part of the castle, and my heart sank. And I thought, that is not climbable. It's not free climbable. It's not aid climbable. I think we're going to have to call this the high point. And so I yelled down to Zach, you know, Zach, I got some bad news, man. I don't see us summiting. I don't think we can continue beyond this point. The rock offers no protection. It's just old epic chaos. And it wouldn't take a bolt, even if we had the bolts to put in, which we didn't. And everything was hollow and exfoliating, and it was unclimbable. And I said, so as I see it, there are two options now. I can try to find some good rock here and place one bolt, and then all lower off the one bolt, and we can bail to the ground. Or I can still place the bolt, because there is no gear here at all, and I can belay you up to me, just so you can be here and have a look also. And he said, I want to come up to where you are. And so the only rock that would accept a bolt is down at ankle level. And so I had this horrendous time with hand drilling down at ankle level between my legs, pounding with this hammer for a long time in an awkward position. And then also feeling kind of discouraged because I, at that point, was fairly sure we were not going to summit. And long story short, I get the bolt in, Zach gets up there and kind of agrees with my assessment. And then he said, and this was what changed everything. He said, let me climb up on the turret itself, because I think from the vantage point it offers us, we can see more of the summit and kind of see around this corner. And it just might be that from that vantage point, there's some option around the corner.
Okay, so as I understand it, you're between the pencil and the cup.
Right.
And he's looking now at the pencil going, well, if I climb up the top of the pencil,
yeah,
I'll get a better view of the cup.
That's right.
Okay.
And the top of the pencil is only maybe 10 feet higher than where I am.
Okay.
And it's just a scramble.
And the summit is still how many feet up
away? Oh, probably 50 or 60.
Okay.
All right. And directly above us is just overhanging garbage, unclimbable rotten rock.
So I kind of have a sense that the cup, if you will, of this tower is a golf tee. It expands as it goes up. So you kind of look up and there's this junk kind of hanging over you.
At this point, it does, yeah. Okay. At this point,
in that area.
Yeah, beyond that junk, it turns to low angle terrain all the way up to the Muav limestone layer.
Okay.
I think on a lot of spires that have hard layers on top, it is very much like a golf tee, with the softer rock eroding away under the harder layer.
Right.
And that is the case with Grey Castle, but it's not like a golf tee. It's kind of a small island of Muav that remains.
Mm-hmm. Right, is the golf ball on top.
Yeah.
Of the tee, if you will. So to climb the pencil, or this little tower of the castle, you're in a chimney, is that right? You're both in this chimney?
At that point, it's wider. It's probably 6 feet wide. It's kind of a notch. We're in a notch.
All right. Yeah. All right. And so he's looking, let's try here and see what's up there. All mm-hmm. right, so then what happened?
So I keep him on belay, but it's just a scramble up onto the turret. And he goes to the far side of the turret and kind of leans out and looks around the corner of the castle or the cop. And he says, I think there might be a way. It doesn't look like it from where you are, but it looks like if you can get around the corner, there's a ledge that gets wider and you can you can get out along that. It looks like it might even have occasional protection. And then you'd have to diagonal up toward that summit cap of Muav and go through some pretty nasty looking stuff. And I said, okay. And so he comes back down and I said to Zach, I gotta tell you, I'm not gonna lead this next pitch. I think it's beyond the level of climbing that I'm willing to commit to. It's too bold. I think the objective danger is too high. And I think by committing to this pitch, whoever does it, they're really putting themselves at great risk. You could be putting your life at risk. And I think that should be stated out loud before you proceed, if that's what you want to do. And I don't know if Zach agrees with that. But regardless, he said, I'm going to go for it. And I said, okay, I'm going to belay you as best I can. And so he inched his way out around this corner, and he did get occasional protection in. And continued traversing maybe 20 more feet. And then at a certain point, he got some protection in, and he said, okay, I'm going to have to start climbing kind of up and diagonally left. And there's a couple little vertical spots. It's impossible to aid climb here. It's got to be free climbing, and the rock is real bad. So, you know, just watch me. And in my head, I was thinking, there's not much I can do other than belay. I mean, in my mind, a fall from a leader on the third pitch of Grey Castle might result in the rope being severed, and would certainly result in a lot of loose rock being ripped off, which would probably impact the lead climber. So in my mind, it's an X-rated pitch. Climbers apply movie ratings, oddly enough, to bold climbs. So an R-rated climb would be one where you can't fall, you would be injured, or you take a huge fall. An X-rated climb is also you can't fall, but there's death potential, and I would consider this X-rated pitch. The climbing never exceeds about 5-6 in difficulty, but when I was following it, it seemed nearly impossible to me to grab anything with any certainty that it wouldn't rip off. To me, everything was, you know, a 50-50 chance. Well, this could break off, and if it broke off, I would come flying off the wall and take a horrendous pendulum, which could sever the rope. All those things are at least going through my mind. I can't speak for Zach. He has amazing presence of mind and ability to remain calm in extraordinarily stressful situations, and I never noted him to be anything other than calm. So he, without ever sounding ruffled in any way, just continued to the top and communicated with me the whole way. And then he said, I'm at the Muav capstone. It's a simple thing to get on top. I'm going to stop here and build an anchor. You know, the anchor is going to be super solid because the Muav is good rock. And I'll bring you up. And at that point, my spirits lifted and I thought, oh man, we're actually going to summit Grey Castle. And so I start across the traverse. And the other thing we had that was quite the encumbrance was a small haul bag that we had food and water in and some extra gear. And hauling a haul bag up a climb when the pitches are vertical is easy. But when there's a traversing pitch, it becomes a nightmare. And so typically the way a haul bag works, the leader trails a line that's connected to the haul bag. And when the leader gets to the next belay, he pulls on that line. It's called a tag line. And that pulls the haul bag up. But in the case of a traverse, that's not possible because the haul bag will snag on everything. And so in that case, it's more or less up to the second or the follower to get the haul bag up. And so we initially tried to cut the haul bag loose because I really did not want to climb with a haul bag on my back, knowing that I was barely going to be able to climb this anyway. And I didn't want extra weight throwing off my balance if I'm climbing on this rotten rock. And also even a fall from the follower would be bad because you'd still take a pretty significant pendulum and you would absolutely be injured. So I didn't want the encumbrance of the bag. So we initially tried cutting it loose and I tried pushing it out into space around this corner, thinking maybe it'll go all the way to a point directly below Zach and then he can haul it up. And it almost worked, but it got hung up on one of those shelves up above. So as I'm following, I get through the traverse and I'm climbing up and the haul bag is stuck on one of these junky shelves. And every time Zach tries to pull on it, it's knocking rocks down on me. And that's the time I was probably the most scared because it knocked some good sized chunks off that narrowly missed me. I was hitting the helmet multiple times by, you know, maybe baseball sized chunks, similar to what Zach was getting hit with on his belay. And so finally I said, just stop trying to pull it up. I'll have to climb up there and unstick it. And I did that, but then even up above, he couldn't continue to pull it up because it was just knocking too much on me. So then I had to do the moves, kind of manually moving the bag to a certain extent. And then I reached him and we both summited Grey Castle and kind of celebrated on top. He surprised me and pulled out a flask of whiskey out of the haul bag. And so we took some swigs and enjoyed the view.
What's the view like up there?
Well, it's one that no one has ever seen before. And you can, it's the opposite of the Nankoweap Granary view. So you're looking directly upstream with all those meanders right up. You can even just make out the boater trail up to the granaries. And then you can also see downstream probably two miles or so. So it's on a kind of vague bend in the canyon, and you can see both directions. It's uniquely situated with this excellent river view. And it was still early enough in the day that we just had the time to sit on top, which is this beautiful flat. It's completely flat. Muav. There's three or four little beaver tail cactus poking out of it, and that's the only thing growing up there. And it's maybe 25, it's kind of an oval, 25 feet long by maybe 10, 15 feet wide.
Hmm.
And yeah, I did not expect a totally flat summit.
Huh.
I expected some chaos of boulders and yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we spent a while up there, and then Zach said, you know, you just sit here and enjoy this view. It's been a long time coming for you. I'll go down and build a rappel anchor, and when it's done, we'll get off this thing. And so I really have to give Zach all the credit on the ascent of Grey Castle. I mean, I absolutely would have rappelled down at the top of the second pitch had he not persevered there.
Hmm.
Even if I had climbed to the top of the turret and seen what he saw, I would not have let it. So it was him that got us up there. Cool. Just phenomenally good climber. And then he built an anchor there, and we rappelled down right about dusk. And the rappel, as is often the case in climbing, was maybe the most dangerous part. It was impossible to avoid the rock fall. It's not a free hanging rappel, and so the rope traveled across a lot of Bright Angel shale that we just could not avoid. And we were trying to rappel as gingerly as possible, you know, not bouncing much, but just a nice glide. But the rope would just knock stuff off, and dangling below in semi-darkness, it was impossible to get out of the way. And I think we both got nailed with some pretty sizable pieces on rappel.
And you're rappelling off to the saddle.
To the saddle, so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So as I recall, the rappel was about 140 feet. And we were 5 feet below the summit. So it's roughly 140 or 150 from the saddle to the summit, which is a little taller than I suspected it was.
Hmm.
And then we got down about dark and pulled the rope and got the hell out of there. We were both so ready to be back on the ground. If the ground hadn't been all sand, I would have kissed it. And then because it was dark, we didn't get any pictures of Grey Castle itself. And so the next morning we woke up and hiked back up just to take some pictures, because we had none from the approach up.
Okay.
And
and you had 3 days on your permit, so you had tons of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Zach wanted to go back the Nankaweep way, and I wanted to make a loop out of it, so I floated to Quaggint, and went up Quaggint to the Butte Fault, and cool.
And up and over.
Up and over, summited Nankaweep Butte, which is the same thing I did 5 years prior with Everett. And I had jotted down a note 5 years prior in the Nankaweep Butte summit register about our attempt on Grey Castle. And so I thought it would be fitting to do the same thing now that we succeeded.
What did you write?
You know, I don't recall exactly, but it was the first time it was just something generic about attempting Grey Castle and then failing and coming back over to do Nankaweep Mesa and Nankaweep Butte. And then this next time it was something about, you know, Zach and I succeeded, really happy to still be alive and would not recommend the climb to anyone or something like that. And then we met back down in Nankaweep Creek. And all this time, Matthew Brown was supposed to be our third. And then he bailed prior to the trip. And so we weren't expecting to see him. And that night, we were camped in Nankaweep Creek, right where the trail meets the creek. And we were just up late talking And now this is the day after we climbed Grey Castle.
This would be the 25th.
The 25th, the night of the 25th. And we see this headlamp coming down the trail, and both of us make the comment about, man, that person's getting in late, and man, that person's really moving fast for it being this late on the Nankoweap Trail. And then the headlamp heads across the creek right over to where we're camped, and it says, hey guys, it's Matthew, and I brought beer. And so he comes in, that guy's so fast, I think he had gone car to where we were in Nankoweap Creek in like 2 hours.
Wow.
Running, just running the whole, I mean, he had no weight with him, but still, that's remarkably fast. And so he brought in these beers, and he's like, did you do it? And so we shared the story with him.
Cool.
And kind of celebrated. And then the next day he said, give me all the heavy stuff.
Oh, wow.
You know, you guys have been at it for a couple of days now. You should be able to walk out light. So he took the heavy stuff, and I think our exit packs were probably 25 pounds or something.
Nice.
Like that.
That's fun.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was the trip.
What are your thoughts on this? If indeed this is the last named summit documented to be climbed in the state of Arizona, possibly in the continental United States, what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, it adds significance to it, I guess, is one way to think about it. Honestly, a lot of my thoughts go to, why in the hell was this thing ever named? I would still like to know the story of that. And I've looked in some of those Grand Canyon place names books, and it, at least the two I've looked at, it does not appear in there. And I've yet to figure out, I'm assuming it's named after someone, although the castle is gray and does look like a castle. So it could easily be just called that because of its color and shape, but most things are named after someone. So, and it's just, you know, in comparison to other named temples and buttes within the Grand Canyon, it's pretty insignificant. So it just boggles my mind as to why it was named in the first place. And but yes, it is quite significant if it's the last. You know, increasingly in this world, it's very difficult to do firsts. You know, 100 years ago, there were thousands of unclimbed things in the world, including all the highest peaks. And 50 years ago, that number was cut significantly. And as we progress, it is much, much harder to stand in a place where no one has ever stood and to claim a first ascent, especially of something named. So in my mind, that's something pretty significant. To see what no one has seen before. So, and within the Grand Canyon, there are very few of those. I mean, in my mind, the Anasazi, the First Nation peoples, likely stood on almost all of the summits, except the more extreme difficult, the ones of extreme difficulty. And so, yeah, it's a difficult thing to achieve, and it's more rewarding because of that. For me, it's a really profound experience, just standing up there and looking. Hard to put that into words, but a very profound experience.
Where did you go next? Have you been out? Have you been back to the canyon since?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go next?
I climbed Zoroaster.
Okay.
Yeah, I had two prior attempts on Zoroaster, both of which were rained out, and I had another permit, and we climbed what's called the Screaming Sky Crack on Zoroaster, and I climbed it with some good friends. And then I went out and climbed Excalibur and hiked out and climbed Scorpion Ridge, which is an obscurity that I don't think too many people have done.
No. From which arm?
We climbed it from Point Sublime. So we came down to the Flint Tuna Saddle.
Okay.
And then traversed the Supai and then the Red Wall all the way out there, climbed to the summit.
Right.
And did not have time to go onto the arms of the Scorpion.
You didn't. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I keep wondering, along with Jim Haggart, Haggart, if there's a route through one of those arms.
We both looked at the west,
but haven't looked at the east. So,
and I suspect there is a route up the notch between Sagittarius Ridge and Scorpion.
Hmm.
I stood in the notch looking down both sides, and the one side appears. You can't see all of it, but I think you could get up the Red Wall there.
Huh. Okay, interesting. What other hikes are you looking forward to doing in Grand Canyon?
I'm nearing completion of the named summit.
Hmm.
And so two significant ones that I've yet to do are Sinyala and Aqaba. And I have a permit next week to descend 150-mile crossover to Mt. Cat, go up Mt. Cat using your beta to do Aqaba, and then heading out the Sinyala Fault the other direction and climbing Sinyala and then returning the same way.
Okay.
So that's the next thing on the agenda.
Cool. Very cool. I think we've about covered it. Is there anything else I haven't asked you that you want to add?
Don't go climb Grey Castle. It's not worth it.
It's been done. You don't need it. Yeah.
No, there really isn't. That I think that was very thorough. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much. This has just been a really wonderful opportunity to get a chance to record the discussion of someone who has just recently done the first ascent of a named butte in Grand Canyon. And it's a wonderful opportunity to get a chance to visit with you and hear firsthand from you about how you did this. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
With that, this will conclude a Grand Canyon oral history with Jake Daly. Today is Saturday, December 4th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Jake, thank you so very much.
Thank you.